Title of this message is Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Holy, holy, holy. The New Covenant portion is going to be in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 through 16. It's actually a continuation of the things I've been speaking about over the last few weeks. A little bit of a review. I mentioned that physics was first used by men of faith to understand God by viewing how the universe that he created works. Science was a tool of faith. Today, physics is used to deny God. Things have turned a little bit. Two rather brilliant men illustrate this dichotomy clearly. Richard Dawkins is the most vocal and perhaps the principal prophet for the faith in no God. He has absolute faith that there is no God. His mantra is, we no longer need God to explain the workings of the universe. Science is adequate to explain what we observe. On the other end of the spectrum is a man by the name of Gerald Schroeder. He's an Orthodox Jew with multiple degrees from MIT in nuclear physics, as well as earth and planetary sciences. He was on the Atomic Energy Commission of this nation. His work on how time is measured in an expanding universe has helped bring us closer to reconciling the young earth and old earth debate. He has proven that time is not a constant. It's relative. A second is not a second. Time is measured relative to the speed that an object is traveling. Einstein showed this much earlier in the 20th century. And the rate that the expansion of space and time surrounding that object is expanding at. So the speed of the object and the rate of the expansion of space, and he has shown this clearly. In fact, his work has caused some of his colleagues to actually consider the existence of God through some of his computations. Back in the day, a couple thousand years ago, as the church became more powerful, it suppressed new discoveries that were being made by science. The Dark Ages were a direct result of the rejection of reason. The church feared these new discoveries not because it contradicted the existence of God, because it did not, but rather because these discoveries exposed errors in some of the church doctrines which threatened the authority of the church. So they suppressed the discoveries to maintain power. Eventually, they prohibited the reading of the Bible by regular folks so that they would not question the church's authority. A rejection of reason results in a fragile faith and is a great hindrance to learning. For knowledge to increase, ignorance must first be accepted. We have to accept the fact that we're ignorant in some areas. If you know everything, you can't learn anything. You already know everything. Another physicist by the name of Richard Feynman, an American physicist, has produced a brilliant little turn of phrase. He said, I would rather have questions that can't be answered than answers that can't be questioned. And this is true for both the theologian and the scientist. Both are subject to the rejection of reason. We're seeing it today all the time. Science has rejected reason. We see this with global warming. We see this with the Wuhan flu. It's continual. Reason is being rejected for political concerns. The things are not making sense. And most people are recognizing this disconnect between what is reasonable and what is being done. Today, science is declaring certain facts to be beyond question. That's never happened in science before. That's everything is subject to questions. This fear persists in the church as well. A few years back, NASA sent a probe to Mars to search for life. One pastor in his weekly radio show declared, and quite boldly, I might add, if there is life on Mars, then the Bible is not true and our faith is false. And I had the same reaction Pam just had. What? That conclusion is not supported by the premise. It's ridiculous. His rationale was life on other planets is not mentioned in the Bible. I believe and have faith in what God has said. I am less certain of conclusions derived from what God did not say. Be very cautious when arguing from silence, and certainly don't hinge your faith on things that God did not reveal. You're on very thin ice at that point. God not mentioning life on other planets does not require that we conclude there is no other life in the universe. There's a disconnect there. God is all-knowing. However, all God's knowledge is not revealed in the Bible. How could it be? There aren't enough animals to provide the parchment to record all of God's infinite knowledge. You can't write it all down. It's infinite. Now we see in a glass dimly. There is much we don't know. Deal with it. It's simple. I have no quandary recognizing that I don't know everything. And many times when I am asked a question, my answer is, I don't know. And that is a valid answer. It doesn't diminish me. It acknowledges, I don't know everything. Human reason is limited in regard to comprehending the workings of the universe, and even more insufficient in its ability to comprehend the creator of that universe. A teachable spirit welcomes new discoveries. And the truth be known, our arguments are less about the discoveries themselves and more about what those discoveries mean, how those discoveries are applied, if we are honest. A belief in the God of the Bible presents us with a truly profound and bizarre conundrum. Although God's presence surrounds and permeates all of his creation, he is at the same time kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. He is holy, holy, holy. The word holy is actually an extrapolation. The word kadosh literally means to separate out or to be separate. Romans chapter 1, Paul gives us a definition of the word holy. I have been separated out of the world unto God. You can't just be separated. You got to go from one thing to another. I've been separated out of the world unto God. That's the definition of holy. In Hebrew, if you want to produce the superlative, you double the word and make one of those words plural. So kadosh kadashim, the holy of holies, the most holy place. The seraphim that hovered above the throne of God declare him to be kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. Three times the highest superlative, as silly as that sounds. Of all God's characteristics, separate is the most profound. God is different from everything in his creation. His presence accounts for the majority of what fills the heavens and the earth, yet so separate, so different from that creation, that it is impossible to observe him. And there are many reasons for this, but primarily, God is infinite, which means he has no borders. You can't put borders around the infinite. As soon as you do, it is no longer infinite. How can one observe something without borders? If there is no edge, we cannot isolate that shape, and I cannot distinguish that thing from what surrounds it. I have edges. I have a place where I end, and something else begins, and so you can distinguish me from that wall behind me, from this pulpit, from the floor, etc. If those borders disappeared, I would disappear. I would become part of my surroundings. This is the science of camouflage. To so obscure the borders of something that it simply blends in and disappears. You can't see it. God has employed camouflage, and we'll see this in just a moment. The glory of God is revealed in two ways, as I've said, over the course of the last two times I spoke. Knowledge, God is understood in two ways. Knowledge revealed in his word, and knowledge derived from observing God's creation, which reveals his glory. And these aren't really two different roads. They are two lanes on the same road. Same road has two lanes. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 22 gives this indication. The Jews seek a sign. They seek revelation knowledge. The Greeks seek wisdom, reason, the accumulation of knowledge, the accumulation of understanding how that knowledge works, and then wisdom, the proper application of that knowledge and understanding. The discoveries in physics and cosmology in the 20th and 21st centuries have fundamentally altered how science views the universe. We don't spend much time on it, and I don't know why, but these discoveries enrich the theologian. At the beginning of the 20th century, when I was in school back in the 1950s, in the middle of the 20th century, the universe was thought to be eternal and infinite. Today, science believes that the universe had a beginning and that it is expanding. The fact that it's expanding means it's not infinite. The infinite can't get larger. It's already infinite. It can't be expanding. So the fact that it's expanding means it's finite. And it has a beginning. That's not a great surprise to the theologian. The very first word of the Bible, Bereshit, is in the beginning. God declares immediately that there was a beginning and he was the source. This discovery integrated what God said to be was true with what we observe to be true. It was a profound discovery for the believer. Other discoveries further revealed God's axiomatic truths. Dawkins declares that science is adequate to explain the workings of the universe. This statement reveals hubris more than knowledge, to be perfectly honest. Science has already conceded that it cannot account for 95% of the universe. They don't know where it is. They can't find it. And the half half of the baryonic material that makes up the 5% that we can see was missing up until very recently. We found it. Yeah. Like me and my keys. I put them down. I can't find them. I know I have them. I drove the car here. But I can't find them. Then I find it. Mazel tov. Now I can drive home. In our search for knowledge, what has been revealed is our profound ignorance. And wise men accept that. This missing stuff, this 95% of the universe that is missing, has been dubbed dark material, dark matter, and dark energy. And it's called dark because it can't be seen. It has nothing to do with spiritual darkness. It's called dark because we can't see it. The same reason we call a black hole black. It absorbs all light, and we can't see it, but we know it exists. The existence of dark matter was deduced mathematically by observing the effects of this dark matter on what we can see. It was a deduction. Let me explain. Man's technology has increased to the point we can map the universe. Extraordinary. As the cartographers of old, man seeks to draw his surroundings on a piece of paper to determine where he is in relationship to the time and space that surround him. It's an obsession with man. We're just obsessed with it. This mapping revealed a shape to the universe, a form. There are clusters of stars that form galaxies. There are as well clusters of galaxies which eventually coagulate and form superclusters. And we've mapped this in 3D on computer imaging. And you can look around it like you would if you're going to online look for a house. You can go through and but the arrangement of these clusters, as seen through Hubble and the various radio arrays of radio telescopes, produced a deep confusion. It revealed that there's just simply not enough matter and energy to produce the forces necessary to create the present form of the universe. In other words, what we see is impossible. It exists, but it doesn't follow the laws of physics. Now, some might conclude, well, God's ways are not our ways, and as high above the heavens as we don't understand all the laws of physics. I get Seth an answer, but it's not very satisfying for me. It's not very satisfying for others, and the question nags. For others, this observation forced the conclusion that there is more matter and more energy than we can see or quantify. There has to be. Matter produces gravitational forces, and it's a formula. You can determine how much, and there's just not enough. So there must be more matter that we can't see. The deduction. So this dark matter provides the gravitational forces necessary to hold the universe together, while dark energy is the force that drives the expansion or the spreading out of the universe. This has been observable. The universe is expanding. There is a redshift. Everything is moving away from everything else. To the scientists, this reconciles what we see with the laws of physics, and they're satisfied. To the theologian, to the man of faith, this discovery is filled with awe and wonder. Have I just seen the hand of God working presently within his creation? my spirit rose up and was excited when I heard this. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 22, he who sits above the circle of the earth, the one who stretches out the universe like a curtain. Could this dark stuff be concealing the hand of God as he continues to spread that universe out? My soul leapt. Have I just seen the hand of God? Does God hide himself in darkness? He said it to the psalmist declares it. Psalm 18, verse 12. God made darkness his hiding place, which surrounds his sukkah. Now that word is translated pavilion, tabernacle, but the word there is sukkah. The dwelling place of God, he has shrouded, he has hidden with darkness. To me, the discovery of this dark matter and dark energy affirmed my faith in the one who is shrouded by it. It is evidence where there's a shadow, there's a light. Although I cannot see God, his presence within this dark cloud surrounds and fills this creation. I differ only with the conclusion that science has come to. It is not the dark matter and the dark energy that brings order and form to the creation. The one who does that is the one who is hidden within that arafel, that choshech, that darkness, as he said in Psalm 18. Does that make sense? Faith and science agree. There are things that exist that cannot be seen. The theologian calls it faith, the evidence of things that are unseen. Science deduces the existence of what cannot be seen by the effects that unseen has on things we can see. Crude example, and it's crude because it's not a precise analogy, because I can see a bullet when it's standing still. But that digression aside, when a bullet is fired from a rifle, I can't see the bullet. It's too small and it's traveling too fast. I have a range out on my land. It goes from 300 to 500 to 700 to 1,000 yards. And I have groups of guys come out. They're special forces guys, SWAT guys, and they love the long range, at least the sniper guys that are on their teams. And most of them, well, all of them, have suppressors, silencers as they're inaccurately referred to. And they'll sit 500 to 1,000 yards away, and they will fire off around. And now we don't have the sophisticated optics that they have in military and such, and so we really can't, the spotter can't see from the 1,000 yards. So what we do is we find a man who doesn't really care for his life too much, typically me, and we send him down to the target. He's about 20 yards from the target, and he's got a radio, and he's in communication with the people who are shooting. And they'll fire off that round, and you can't hear the report of the rifle at that distance. Yet you can deduce that that rifle was fired. How? When that bullet, which can't be seen, interacts with that target, there is an explosion of energy. Sound rings forth from the metal. The target, which was still, is now waving, and there's a splash of lead all over the target, and I can tell you exactly where that bullet hit. I can't see the bullet, but I know the bullet exists because of its interaction with what I can see, the target. Now, I got to use that experience with a physicist friend of mine. I have a friend who's got a couple of degrees in different disciplines of physics. One of them is particle physics. And I went to ask him a question about the expanding universe, and yet there's galaxies that collide. And, you know, that didn't make, I couldn't reconcile that in my mind, and I figured, let me drink from these waters. And we were talking, and he's talking about how this dark energy is spreading out the universe in all directions. And I said, wow, that sounds just like what God said in Isaiah 40. And you could see an immediate change of countenance. His brow crinkled, and he got this really disgusted look on his face. And I said, what? He said, look, I don't want to talk about this. I'm a scientist. I believe in what I can see and what I can quantify, what I can measure. I said, that's ridiculous. You have a PhD in quantum physics. Your entire discipline of study is on things you can't see. That was a waste of money. I said, you know these particles exist. How? Because you may not be able to see the particle, but you can see the effects that particle has on what you can see. It interacts, and immediately the particles you can see change direction. That's God. You've just seen God. I can't see my God, but you can see the difference in people with whom God has had contact. I'm not the same man that I was prior to my contact with God. I am different. I changed course. I no longer walk in the same way I used to. His response was, I have never thought of it that way. I said, you should. It's the truth. Nowhere is God more holy, more distinguished than as he exists in eternity. Eternity is fundamentally different from our finite reality. Creation had a beginning, and both science and theology accept the fact that it will have an end. It has a beginning, it has an end. And therefore, in its current condition, the essential characteristic of creation is change. Everything changes. The universe has changed dramatically from the time this service first began. It's expanded by millions and millions of miles. Stars that didn't exist were born and began to shine. There has been stars that had existed and have died. They've gone dark. All in the time this service has been going on. Change requires that one thing cease for another thing to come into existence. This is the essence of Jewish thinking on death. The numerous biblical and rabbinical parables on seeds reveal this truth with clarity. The seed must die for the plant to be born. That's a nice poetic way to say it. More literally is the seed must change. Death is not an end. The life of the seed changes appearance and is now viewable in the form of a plant. It's the same life, just changed. At my death, my existence does not end. I am changed in the twinkling of an eye. 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Thessalonians 4. Are very clear on what happens when I die. The glory of the earthly body is one thing, and at the death of the physical body, it is changed into a spiritual body. We dealt with this in depth a month ago or so, which has a different appearance, a different light, a different glory. This understanding renders death a little less ominous, a little less final. Conversely, the essential nature of eternity is it does not change. My people refer to God in his eternal existence as Ein Sof. The word Ein means completely devoid of something, absolutely nothing. And Sof is end. We have the Mem Sofit, the final Mem, the end. It's a different form of the same letter when it's at the end of a sentence. Ein Sof means the one without end. Some thought this definition insufficient and added that God is without beginning or end, the one who does not change. And they took that definition from God's own mouth. In Malachi chapter 3, verse 6, Ki ani Adonai Lashanti. I am the Lord. I do not change. Interestingly, the author of Hebrews gives the same description about Yeshua in Hebrews 13:8. He is the same, unchanging, yesterday, today, and forever. Nitzchi, he is timeless. We don't really understand the profundity of that statement to the Jewish mind in the first century. The author of Hebrews is connecting Yeshua with Ein Sof. There is a direct connection there, the one who doesn't change. Now, I have to accept that on faith, because it is a concept utterly beyond my existence. Everything that I am aware of exists in time and therefore changes. You know, the old saying, it's become trite now, but it doesn't detract from the absolute truth. You can't step into the same stream twice. It is an absolute fact. The second time, the waters are different. It's not the same water. The stream itself is different. The erosion has deepened it and widened it. And you're not the same the next time you walk into that stream. You have changed. Everything has changed. The only place I ever called home on this earth is Teton Valley, Idaho. And I took the youth of this congregation when I was taking them out. I took them back up to my old cabin, my old place, the place I called home. And I got there, and you cannot step into the same stream twice. Teton Valley, Idaho was not the same place. Teton Valley, Idaho, that I know exists now only here. Places completely and utterly different. You can't step into the same stream twice. The existence of God, his unity, his eternal nature, are attributes of God outside this physical creation. The part of God that is kadosh, 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 utterly separate, utterly distinguished. For God to appear within this creation, he has to limit that presence. Tzimtzum. I have stressed over the last four or five messages this essential concept, because of a lot of our discussions on God don't distinguish God in his eternal condition from God as he limits his presence and appears within this creation. And there is a difference. We cannot see God in his eternal condition. No man can see me and live. It's just impossible. However, there is much we can learn about God in these limited exposures to the eternal one, these limited manifestations of God. We can observe his behavior in this world. We can understand how he wants us to implement his commandments by viewing his behavior in this world. Every time we brush up against eternity, we are changed by that vastness. Our minds and souls expand, and we no longer see God, the creation, or ourselves in the same way. You cannot come into the presence of God and leave unchanged. It is simply impossible. Jacob wrestled with an angel who was identified by the four-letter name of God. Jacob was not the same after that wrestling match. That change was declared by the change of his name. He went from Yaakov to Yisrael, a prince of God. The Memra, the angel of the Lord, El Shaddai, El Elyon, are all names that we have given to God's appearances within this physical creation. And where these manifestations of God occur, heaven and earth touch. Eternity and the finite mingle. The border between them is erased. And here is where we are given insight into the mind of God. These appearances give us another set of attributes for God. Not the eternal attributes that must be accepted by faith, but the attributes derived from observing God's activity on earth. Observation. And when we are, of course, commanded to mimic that behavior. In the New Covenant portion for this week, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, quotes Leviticus 19, verse 2. Be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Our sages asked the question, can man be as holy as God? And the answer, of course, in typical Jewish fashion is yes and no. We cannot mimic God as he exists outside this creation, for we are part of this creation and could not exist outside of it. So we can't mimic God as he exists eternally. But we can observe and mimic his behavior within this creation. Yeshua was the most profound illustration of a man mimicking God in this world from his own lips. I do nothing on my own initiative, only what I see and hear the Father say and do. That's the mimicking that we're talking about in Be Holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Although at first a condescending moniker, to be a Christian means to be Christ-like. The WWJD, the What Would Jesus Do bracelet, so popular a few decades ago, is tantamount to the techelet, the fringe of blue on the talit. It is supposed to remind us to keep the commandments of God, to be holy, for the Lord your God is holy. The Sermon on the Mount presents a practical theology on how God would have us behave in this world. And he walked that theology out, and we observed God behaving in this world as an example of how we should behave. The ultimate goal of every believer is to live in a state of continual divine connection. To be so immersed in the presence of God that we are in a continual conversation with him. Constant. Yeshua told me if I keep his commandments, he and the Father will live in me. Ein Sof, and his most profound manifestation in this world, Yeshua, live within me. That is an overwhelming, breathtaking thought. My neshama, my divine breath, the soul that God breathed into me. Here's the words of God walking on the wind. And those words instruct me in his ways. I've always talked to myself from the time I was a little kid. As far back as I can remember, I've talked to myself. Sometimes I was just fleshing out ideas. At other times, there were fights. My teachers loved it, really. Some of them thought me quite mad, while others found it to be humorous when they see me in a heated debate with myself. Both err, not being privy to that conversation. Most of the time, my divine soul is instructing me on what it needs, and my flesh is making a case for what it wants. Last week, the argument became rather heated, very vocal. My eyes were closed, I was sitting back in the chair, and I was going at it with me over some point. I happened to win every one of those arguments and lose every one of those arguments. When the argument was over, I looked up and Mary was standing at my side. She had a little smile on her face and a look on her face that said to me, "Don't get involved." We'll work this out. And she waited patiently until I was done arguing with me because she had a question she wanted to ask. Sometimes what is perceived as senility or madness is in reality a man drawing nigh to God and answering God's call, "Come, let us reason together." God is always calling, "Ayeka, where are you? Let's talk. Let's reason together. We need to work this out." The highest duty of the soul is to reflect on and join with God. These reflections will always cause the student to inquire of the teacher, and those discussions are not madness. They reveal access to Mikor Chaim, the fountainhead, the very source of life itself. And I pray that you find this madness, that you find and forever drink of those waters to the dregs. Father, in Yeshua's name, there is no greater blessing than to know that you have, that you inhabit me, that the same one who fills the heavens and the earth, the creator of that heaven and earth, has chosen to make his sukkah in me, to reason with me, to teach me, to lead me and to guide me in the paths, the ancient and good paths of righteousness. May we recognize this as the temple of the living God, the place where you reside. And may we make, as the psalmist declares, inquiry continually, that you might teach us, that you might fill our hearts and minds and souls with wonder and awe, that our eyes might behold the true reality of your presence and not be dissuaded by this world. In Yeshua's precious name, amen.